take it from us is taking a well-deserved break at the moment, so today's episode is a repeat program.
Mental Health Radio, take it from us, and that's our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself. And respecting ourselves and others is critical, I think, to ensure our emotional health and our mental health. Well, I'm Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran, and Mental Health Radio is brought to you and funded by Framework Trust. So today we acknowledge the key work of Anxiety New Zealand, a trust that focuses primarily on anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorders and phobias. However, it also treats other associated conditions related to anxiety. In the studio is Chief Executive Sarah Woolard, who is passionate about removing barriers to mental health support, and psychologist Nadine Isler. That's the correct pronunciation?
It is.
I don't know whether I'm allowed to announce that Nadine is heavily pregnant, so she's struggling to be comfortable in our studio today. But welcome to both of you to Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. It's the first time, I think, Sarah, that you've done a live interview in a studio like this.
It is, Sheldon.
Yeah, and Nadine too. You've done the odd radio interview on the phone, but not coming into the studio.
That's right.
Right. So, how often have you done that? You're an experienced radio person, are you?
I wouldn't say experienced, but a few.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about Anxiety New Zealand, Sarah. You've been there a considerable time and grown through the ranks.
Yeah, thanks, Sheldon. So a little bit about me. My name is Sarah and I started as a volunteer in 2010. I worked on our 24-hour helpline for about 2 years and then moved to managing the practice. So my role now is CEO, and we've got an incredible team of pretty passionate people, and I really love working there.
Yeah, well, you built the team up to a large group of psychologists and supporters.
Yeah, it's a pretty good bunch of people. We've got 10 psychologists on board and about 100 volunteers at the moment. So we're a non-profit charity, and we specialise in providing support, treatment and education for anxiety and depression. And the Trust provides a range of services for kids right through to older adults. People don't need a diagnosis to use a service. Some people may or may not be looking for one. Mm-hmm. And we also help the wider community by educating health professionals and also other organisations. So in total, we support around 25,000 people per year, and we do that on a pretty small budget, but with a team of skilled people.
Right, and Nadine, how long have you been associated with Anxiety New Zealand?
Coming up 2 years now.
Right. So it had its change of name. It was well known as the Phobic Trust.
That's right.
Now it's changed its name to, a name that is more contemporary with the issues that New Zealand society is facing.
Yes, well, look, we've got a long history. We originally started in 1983 and were officially incorporated in 1987. And yes, we changed our name from the Phobic Trust of New Zealand 5 years ago to Anxiety New Zealand Trust. And we've really continued to evolve ever since. We've got a lot more services. We've got a great volunteer board of trustees with excellent representation of diverse communities. So we've got some Samoan and some Chinese representation there, and some good clinical knowledge. So it makes me really happy to hear the positive feedback that we get from others about what we do.
Right.
So we work in mental health, and I think first off, it's so important that we walk that walk, that we're a supportive place to work, and that we're modelling those ways to well-being.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that helps encourage good work culture. I mean, I could be biased, but I think it's something that we shine at.
Oh, I'm sure you're a very objective CEO, Sarah. But Nadine, where did you come from before joining Anxiety New Zealand?
So previously I was working at Massey University in the student health clinic there, and my background is in health psychology, so particularly where physical health issues intersect with mental health.
Right. Well, it's very important to blend those two things, to blend our physical health and our mental health, to have a holistic approach, isn't it? Is that one of the sort of planks that you promote in your work as a psychologist?
Well, it's certainly something I believe in very much, yeah, that you can't separate the two, and we're finding more and more evidence that the two are very closely interlinked.
So when you see clients, do you find that clients separate the two, or they see the two very much combined?
You know, it certainly depends on the person, but we will get people coming in that will have been referred for a certain physical symptom that they might believe is completely independent of the mental issue. And it takes some time to be able to say, well, perhaps what you think is your heart or a panic, you know, a heart attack or something similar is in fact a panic attack.
Right.
So that does, yeah, that does happen.
Yeah, well, I think anxiety can play great tricks on us, can't it? And it's interesting that you mention that link with anxiety and a fear that we're having a heart attack or we have heart problems. And I guess my past history bore that out, and I often had heart checks and exercise ECGs, and I was as fit as a buck rat, but I still had these pains in my chest, and I guess I had to learn that was more about my stress than about my physical health. But I think it's a very good example where the two combine.
Absolutely, and there's such a wide range of physical symptoms that people can experience, you know, from insomnia to digestive issues to skin problems to all sorts of things that can actually be, like you say, from stress or anxiety.
Right. So really stress and anxiety can have a pretty traumatic effect on the quality of our lives, Sarah.
Absolutely. And we see that day in and day out. It's an incredible amount of people who've been assessed even over years at in other mental health, in other health domains, and then they're finally sent to us by a gastroenterologist or by a cardiologist, and the issue is anxiety.
Right.
There's been a lot of money poured into that issue with no result before coming to us.
So they've poured a lot of money into their physical health by going to see, as you say, cardiologist or enterologist, gastroenterologist, whatever.
Very much so. And in some cases, it's not just that, it's the stress, the extra stress that person goes through for a longer period of time, rather than getting the right help the first time.
Right. So when we have that fear that we may have a dicky heart, or we may have cancer or stomach cancer or whatever, because we're experiencing these pains, that all enhances or intensifies the anxiety.
Yes, it can do, and as our anxiety increases, we often end up scanning our bodies for symptoms, and then again, that can make our heart rate go up and make us feel more stressed. There's not a lot of symptoms that you can experience that aren't related to anxiety, so it does get a bit tricky for GPs even to get a good sense on what might be going on. But that's your first port of call, is to go see a GP,
right.
Go and have a good chat about what's happening, and then start the ball rolling there.
Right. So you're just taking you back to you used the word practice, that anxiety in New Zealand is a practice. So you view it as being like a GP practice, because you have professional psychologists like Nadine who are running a practice, running a counselling service, running an anxiety reduction practice.
Yes, that's correct. So the trust does a range of things. We do provide, we have a 24-hour helpline, but we also run one-to-one services. So we have around 10 psychologists who can do a range of therapeutic interventions at our clinic. So that's using CBT or ACT, mindfulness-based therapies, DBT, for example. And one of the great things about us is we can actually help people access funding if they're a low-income earner or a student, to access up to 30 funded appointments. So we end up seeing a lot of university students retired people as well, or people who are underemployed or unemployed, to give them support. We also have doctors, so we can do psychiatric assessment, medication monitoring, a range of things. Another great part of our service is we offer peer support groups for people with lived experience of anxiety, and also we have another group for social anxiety, which is incredibly popular with the that sort of 18 to 25 year old age range.
Well, you've listed some very significant support there. How can people access that list specifically? Because I understand that Anxiety New Zealand has a new website now, a flash new website, and is that up and running now? It's
Yeah, we do. We have a new website, which is fantastic, and it is... we're really thankful to Chris Boyd at Eden Arts Club for designing the new website, and look, we couldn't have done it without him. It's also awesome because we can now upload a whole range of new content and make it really valuable for people who are visiting. We've got actually a video that we'll be launching in the next week, and that's a big thanks to Alex at AL Media. They're a real great bunch of people to work with, and basically, we had an idea to produce a video, and we ran that past our team and then past the Mental Health Foundation. And then a fellow called Peter, who's he's a pretty neat guy. He's got lived experience of anxiety and just an amazing life. And he's come along and talked about his experiences and what it's like to live with anxiety. And it's quite inspiring to see. So we'll be launching that later this week. And if any listeners are interested, they can visit our Facebook page or go to our website.
So Peter features in that YouTube clip
video?
Yeah.
He does. Yep, it talks about his journey and the things that became important in his life to maintain his wellness and live a pretty inspiring life.
You've met Peter Nadine, have you?
I haven't personally, no. But I have heard a lot about him.
Right, well, I've met him a couple of times. He's certainly a ball of energy and a great ambassador for, well, getting anxiety talked about, communicated and that sort of thing. Well, let's take a music break. We'll give the girls a little bit of a break, and I'm going to play some music from a Keb Moe CD called Just Like You. I bought this at the Salvation Army Hospice Shop in Takapuna when I was at the market there. It cost me $2 and it's already given me thousands of dollars of enjoyment and probably anti-anxiety or anxiety reduction as well, because it's such great blues music. So the first track is You Can Love Yourself.
Like dust on an empty shelf, just remember, you can love yourself. How we doing out there? My mother says she loves me, but you know, she could be jiving too. Everybody's always criticizing everything that I do. I work 9 to 5, do the best I can. I try to please the boss. I bought a big old house and a brand new car, and then it laid me off. Well, if nobody loves you and you're feeling like dust on an empty shelf, just remember, you can love yourself. And I'm bold. So I called my old friend Hazel May. I asked her out for a little date. She said, I'm married now and I got 3 little kids. Boy, you're just a little too late. But if nobody loves you and you're feeling like dust on an empty shelf, just remember, you can love yourself. And if nobody loves you and you're feeling faded like dust on an empty shelf. Just remember, you can love yourself. You can love yourself.
Was Keb Moe off my Salvation Army Hospice Shop purchase, and the track was called You Can Love Yourself, and just like our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself, it's got some wonderful messages in there about loving yourself, particularly if you get dumped by your partner. So so we're talking today to the CEO of Anxiety New Zealand, Sarah Woolard, and psychologist Nadine Isler, about Anxiety New Zealand specifically. But I think we need to talk some more about the prevalence of anxiety and the fact that mental health has, from the suicide rate, from the government's inquiry into mental health and addictions, from so many things, the latest, of course, the politician from Botany who sectioned to Middlemore Hospital's mental health unit. All of that lifts the profile of mental health, doesn't it? And there are a lot of places where anxiety is being addressed by all sorts of professionals, and clearly Anxiety New Zealand is one of those places. Why are we such an anxious society, Sarah? Or Nadine, you're going to address this, are you?
Well, it's hard to tell, really, whether it's just that we're talking about it more and that it's more recognised, or if it's in fact on the rise. I would suggest it's probably both. You know, from our perspective, it's fantastic that we're talking about it more and that people are accessing help and that it's becoming slowly less and less stigmatised. But at the same time, it does also seem as though more people are suffering the symptoms and you know, than ever before. And if you look at research where people are reporting their symptoms, so in fact talking about what they're feeling rather than just saying I have anxiety or I have depression, if they're talking about how they're feeling, it does seem as though more people are actually experiencing some of the more negative side effects of anxiety and depression.
So you're saying that people in Kiwis are learning how to talk about their feelings?
Heaven forbid.
Terrible.
I think there are just so many things that we could point to in modern life that are contributing to more pressure in terms of our mental health. Just the sheer pace of life these days. We've probably got more control over things in certain ways than ever before, so we're able to actually lower our immediate distress, which can mean that actually we're less good at tolerating distress when it does inevitably happen. So you might be able to control the temperature of your environment all of the time, for example, and have air conditioning in your house and in your car and so on and so forth, but there might still be things that happen to you in your everyday life that you absolutely cannot control, and then you're less equipped to deal with it. So that's one theory. And then, of course, just in terms of financial pressure and, we've got, 1 in 7 households in New Zealand living in poverty at the moment. All those sorts of things will certainly be contributing as well.
And more than 50% who are now renting in Auckland, which is an unheard of statistic, really, when you come to think that New Zealanders have owned their own homes for so many years. And it's, I think, a tradition that we own our own homes. So doesn't that require a very big adjustment, and we lose control when we're a tenant in many ways. So though, Nadine, you've said that we in certain areas we may have more control, I think we have less control if we are a renter and a tenant. We don't have control over the rent. We may not have longevity in terms of staying in that place because the landlord wants to redevelop the section and build build units all over it and those sorts of things. So doesn't that lead to a greater insecurity?
Absolutely, yeah. And I should have said before, it's more perceived control. You feel as though you can do small things in your environment, but in fact we're working more hours for less pay. Mm-hmm. You know, you might be in a difficult situation where you're having to move house more often, and like you said, yeah, we're working the same sort of hours but aren't able to fund a house deposit or something like that compared to previous generations.
Well, I mean, that's the crucial thing, isn't it? We've got to have $200,000, $250,000 to be able to place a deposit on a home in Auckland. And I guess that's why so many people are perhaps leaving Auckland. But then doesn't that mean that they're separating themselves from family and friends and work and their whole support structure? Is Sarah, do you want to make any comment here? Are you leaving it? You'd like to leave it to Nadine?
Family and friends are incredibly important to mental well-being. And if those connections are severed, or if people are forced to move out of the communities that they're connected in, then absolutely that can have an effect on mental well-being. That's why it's so key that people, wherever they are finding ways that they are every day putting those good things into their lives which support their well-being and help build their resilience.
Right. Well, what about social media? I mean, I transferred from my old phone to a new phone just last week. And I got Vodafone to transfer all my contacts and my apps and all that sort of thing. But then I discovered that I was having difficulty accessing those apps. And that was incredibly stressful because I do Airbnb and I needed to be able to communicate with guests that were due to arrive. So, I mean, while mobiles and technology can help us, Nadine, how do you think, the new media, the new technology increases our stress?
Well, we're also accessible 24/7. That's right. The other problem too, and phones are, in social media and computers and all that sort of thing, are often designed to be addictive. So when you have the little red circle popped up on your phone with a message or something that you need to attend to, you've got this immediate need to go and solve that particular problem, and then you sort of have the resulting dopamine rush in your brain that says, okay, well done, and so you do it again, and so you're a bit of a slave to your phone.
Right.
And like you say, when things don't work that well and technology isn't playing along, that can add incredible amounts of stress.
I mean, I think Kiwis are becoming slaves to their phone. I took a ferry ride down to Half Moon Bay from the city yesterday, and here's a family waiting for the ferry to go back, and they've all got their phones out. You know, the kids have got their phones out. Mum and Dad have got their phones out. They're not communicating. And so what's the impact of that, do you think?
Well, nothing good. I think that there's a huge breeding ground for social comparison when it comes to phones and social media as well.
Well, the phones we actually have in front of us, or
partly that, but also what you're accessing. You know, so if you know, you're looking at social media and you're seeing pictures of what somebody else is doing, and of course you only ever see the best stuff from other people's lives in general, and then you've got that social comparison element where you're comparing what you're doing or who you are or how you look with somebody else.
Yeah.
Which is never a positive thing.
Well, I mean, I have two very lovely people from Colombia staying with me at the moment, and they got married 3 years ago, and clearly a very lavish ceremony, and they showed me the photographs of the wedding, and the point of this was that she is a fashion designer and she wanted to show me the dress and how wonderful it looked. But I'm sure, you know, there's a point, well, is this the reason we're spending so much money on weddings? Because we want to present ourselves on social media as having the best and the flashiest and the most luxurious. And so if that's an example, the whole thing is getting completely out of kilter, isn't it?
Not to mention, I'm sure we've all been to a wedding where they've had to deliberately ask everybody to put their phones aside for the day.
Oh.
So that we can, in fact, watch the bride coming down the aisle with our eyes rather than through a screen.
What does that say to you about
being in the moment and
how much our phones are our making us slaves?
Absolutely, yeah, and it limits your ability to actually be in the moment and enjoy what you're experiencing, because that's a skill that as humans we really need to continue practicing. Mm-hmm. And if we're constantly distracted by phones or videoing something instead of really truly being there, we lose that skill.
Well, I mean, I go back to my experience waiting for the ferry yesterday afternoon. A girl who's got all sorts of bags and a backpack and she's carrying something else, and she said to me, "Excuse me, but look, I've left my phone in the boot of my father's car and he's just driven off. Could you ring him for me?" She was clearly, and she was going to Waiheke Island, like she was going into the city, and then so she wasn't going to have her phone. I mean, have you got examples, Nadine, where when people lose their phones or they leave them somewhere, what's their reaction?
It's a bit of an addiction, isn't it, to actually have your phone right with you. And it goes further than just leaving it somewhere, which would be distressing to many people. But also, I do see that also in a therapy context, that people will check their phone. You know, in therapy, you'll find it very, very difficult to, in fact, put the phone face down or in their bag away from them. And that's getting to something that I'd be describing it as an addiction.
So what is this doing to our level of anxiety?
Well, you know, from a physiological perspective, it puts us in a state of sort of permanent fight or flight, because you're constantly aware of something that you are needing to be monitoring and needing to be aware of. And a whole lot of stuff is always happening outside of the room that you're in. And if you feel as though you need to be somehow doing something about that,
right,
you're in a permanent state of feeling like there's something you need to attend to.
I mean, I've been attending workshops at Philosophy New Zealand, and there is a woman there who gets her phone out to get a definition of a word. So we were talking a lot about the word discrimination, and of course that's got a very real meaning to me, and I'm sure to both of you. But discrimination can have the meaning of being discerning. And that was what they were talking about, not being judgmental, but being discerning. So she gets her phone out and reads the definition out. And I think to myself, well, surely we've got the intellectual firepower within this group of 9 or 10 people to be able to discuss this rather than have somebody reading it off their phone.
It's true, and it sometimes, you know, you forget how to do something like that, look up in a dictionary or something, if you're able to take the shortcut of the phone all the time.
Right.
I mean, there would be people that would argue that it's also a positive benefit that we get to have access to all this lovely information, all of this knowledge at the press of a button. But I agree with you that at the same time, you know, we aren't practicing the art of putting our phones down and having that conversation of what we think the word means before we check.
I don't think Kiwis are that great at conversation anyway. And we're not really practicing it, because our phones are getting in the road.
And certainly something we don't practice, we're not getting better at. That's
so
the truth.
At Anxiety New Zealand, are you able to sort of say whether clients are coming to see you because of these sorts of issues?
They are issues that will certainly come up in the context of treatment, yes, right. And it's something we always ask about,
yeah.
You know, devices, social media, things like that, something that I always try and have a conversation about near the beginning to find out what someone's relationship is with technology.
Because in the diagnoses that you address, one of them, according to the website, is obsessive compulsive disorder. Are we becoming becoming obsessive and compulsive about our phones, Sarah, do you think?
It's an interesting question. Look, we're certainly seeing a lot of young ones who are not getting the social practice that perhaps they would have 10 years ago. For example, our numbers in our support group are there's a waiting list to get in, and we're looking at opening up on some other days.
Sorry, can I just interrupt you there for your support group for young people?
For young people, specifically for social anxiety. So what we feel is happening is that young people, if they're not getting the experience in one-to-one conversation, with even having phone calls with other people rather than messaging or on social media, then they're very anxious about when they have to do that. So if you sort of hit 18 and now you're out in the world and you might be moving into tertiary education and find it really difficult to be in those environments when the expectation is that you can have a conversation with somebody or even, as I said, pick up the phone. That's quite a big stressor for a lot of young people, is to answer a phone call, especially if they don't know who's ringing. If it's a private number, many of them, it'll go unanswered.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So really we can use our technology to do things to other people that aren't very pleasant, and we don't actually have to talk to them. I mean, even at my age, when I was just under 70, I had a girlfriend that finished a relationship by text.
Yeah, it certainly is a convenient barrier between being able to put a sort of gate between yourself and a stressful thing. It's easier to even cancel an appointment by text or by email, because then you're not having to speak with that person directly or potentially feeling any kind of embarrassment or concern.
That's fine for the person who knows that they want to cancel, but what about the person who's on the receiving end of that message and suddenly I was faced with this relationship of 2 years going down the swanee?
Oh, it's a tough one, no doubt. It's a tough one.
Well, it was very anxiety-provoking.
No doubt.
You know, and I mean, if you do it by conversation and by discussion, then maybe you get a little bit of warning that things aren't quite as they should be.
Mm.
And you can perhaps address that as well. Nadine, what do you think? Have you had anybody who's finished a friendship or a relationship by text?
Not personally, but for sure, if that's something that somebody is trying to avoid conflict or do something because it's the easy way out, the person on the receiving end is sort of really losing out there, aren't they?
And well, they could be devastated.
Absolutely,
I suggest, and very, they could become incredibly anxious, which could lead to depression. Their mental health, their emotional health could be damaged for some time. Let's come back and talk a little bit about how we're avoiding conflict after another track from Keb Mo, and this one is I'm On Your Side.
Baby, I'm on your side.
property. Come on, baby, just be nice to me. Get with me, baby. I'm on your side. Oh, yeah, get with me, baby. I'm on your side. Get with me, baby. Talk to me, baby. Just let me love you, baby.
Keb Mo from one of my favourite CDs. He's a great blues man, and that was a track called I'm On Your Side. And I guess we do need people on our side, don't we? We're talking today to the CEO of Anxiety New Zealand, Sarah Woolard, and to psychologist Nadine Isler. And we were talking about the impact of technology, of social media, how it may be intensifying anxiety. And I think Nadine used the word conflict. So people are resolving conflict by texting, by emailing, rather than picking the phone up or actually going and seeing the person and saying, well, how are we going to resolve this?
It seems so. And to really understand that behaviour, we need to understand what's called a safety behaviour. And so a safety behaviour is something that you do to try and minimise your anxiety in the short term. But unfortunately, it has the long-term effect of actually increasing your anxiety. So I'll give you an example. If somebody is afraid of dogs, for example, they might avoid all dogs, never come near them, never pat them. And in the short term, that will actually make them feel better because they're avoiding that particular stressful situation. But in the long term, they never learn that the difference between a friendly and an unfriendly dog, and they don't learn that actually it probably would have been okay in most cases to go near a dog. And so it's a similar sort of thing. If you avoid the difficult conversation, if you avoid having to have that emotional
connection,
exactly, or the conflict, or, you know, using some assertiveness, not only do you get rewarded for that in the interim because it feels just more comfortable because you've just escaped from that altogether, you actually don't get to practice that skill.
So is this sort of a reflection of this sort of me, me, me?
Well, it's an anxiety behaviour, certainly. It's you know, and we all tend to want to avoid things that are going to make us feel anxious. It's a natural human survival instinct that you avoid the thing that's dangerous, so to speak. And so it may be
perceived to be dangerous.
Exactly, yes, but our brains don't know the difference between
right.
our proverbial tiger chasing us through the jungle and a difficult conversation with maybe somebody in authority or yeah, someone we're wanting to break up with.
Well, is the mobile the tiger chasing us through the forest?
Well, I think the mobile might be our way of avoiding the tiger altogether, but they're not learning how to deal with it.
Right, so where's this going to take us, do you think? I mean, does it suggest that this is one of the reasons why Anxiety New Zealand is seeing greater demand to address anxiety, do you think, Sarah?
Well, look, you know, partly it's always a bit tough to try and clarify exactly what's driving increase in demand for our services. But we can, you know, definitely say that, you know, at the moment the trust is both with a fence at the top of the cliff, providing education and resources to help people stay well. But we're also with the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, picking up the pieces, and we daily abseil between the two, and that's in large part due to sheer demand for the services. So we're not a crisis service, but that's not to say that we're not people that we're seeing are not going into crisis, or people calling our helpline are not in crisis. Based on that, we work a lot with a range of other health services and community mental health teams and CAT teams across all DHBs in New Zealand.
So the CAT team is the crisis team?
Yeah, CAT team is crisis team. So, yeah, we have pretty regular contact and trying to help people get services.
So how can people access your, you've referred to the 24-7, it's a 24-7 helpline?
Yeah, so it's a 24-7 helpline and they do some pretty amazing work. We answer 95% of calls day or night, which is incredible. It's one of the highest rates in New Zealand. Well, don't quote me, but I'd say it's the highest rate. So we have a range of callers. For example, somebody mid-panic attack that might be pulled over on the side of the motorway or stuck on the harbour bridge. And look, it's normal to worry at times, and it's healthy to have a mechanism, you know, anxiety to motivate us and help keep us safe. But a bit of stress gets us out of bed, and it helps us meet our responsibilities and deadlines. And it also helps keep other people safe too. For example, you know, we keep a close eye on a kid that's on close to the edge of a swimming pool. But sometimes anxiety goes beyond that. And on the helpline, we, for example, we might speak with somebody with intrusive or distressing thoughts around getting sick, that something is contaminated, or worrying that something bad will happen. So a person might be washing their hands a lot, or cleaning, or checking the stove, or the hair straighteners are off, or the front door is locked, for example.
Right.
Yeah, so sometimes people need to have a break from those repetitive thoughts, and that's where the helpline can come in. So they may have escalating anxiety despite doing the thing that usually helps temporarily relieve that anxiety. So in that case, we'd provide some education around what intrusive thoughts are, around anxiety, normalising anxiety, and talk about when intrusive thoughts might signal needing some help. We could teach some distraction techniques and other relaxation exercises.
So what sort of analysis do you do? You've got the capacity to be able to analyse trends in anxiety, trends among the people that are seeing your psychologist like Nadine and the 9 or 10 other psychologists that you've got? Are you able to provide, I guess you provide reports to your board of trustees, do you?
Yes, well, look, we do gather a lot of data, but we spend a lot of time actually at the Coalface helping people rather than doing a lot of analysis. Our clinicians are really focused on individually on the people that they are working with. If we had more funding, if we had somebody in a somebody in a position that could spend some time doing more analysis or research, then absolutely that would be, I think, quite beneficial to New Zealand. For the trust, our biggest issue really is we're only limited by resources, and that's funding.
Right. Mm. So you've been turning the financial well-being of Anxiety New Zealand around, and you've been quite successful in doing that.
Oh, well, look, I'm grateful for a lot of things, but again, our biggest issue is funding. It's really tough to make ends meet without getting a little bit of extra support, and we're really resourceful. Our IT, our accounting, it's all long-term specialist volunteers. We've got 90 volunteers on our helpline, all with lived experience. We provide a lot of training, and we find pretty creative ways to support and reward our volunteers and kind of champion them going forward in their careers. But funding's tight. We're based in the heart of the community in St. Luke's, right across from the mall, and it's a strategic place because we don't believe that mental health issues should be tucked away in a corner. Mental health is the centre of what we do, and it enables us to thrive or not. So I'm really glad that we're visible, but it makes it really hard to pay the rent.
Right.
And so despite a huge amount of goodwill from our team, we're about $60,000 short per year. And, of course, we can't continue being short every year. So that's our focus over the next couple of months, and we're open to any conversation around that.
Right. So where do you get any government funding at all?
We do. Look, so we have a government service contract for our helpline, but not for our one-to-one services or community education. And we do a huge amount there. So we do help around 25,000 people per year. And look, we're the place where other mental health professionals and doctors come when they need a bit of help themselves. And, you know, I'm super proud of that. And we do it with so little. And I think in the past we've been so busy helping everybody else that we haven't really said that we need a bit of help too.
Right. Well, let's come back and talk about how people might be able to help Anxiety New Zealand. We've got another track from Keb Moe, and this one is called Dangerous Mood.
Mm-hmm.
God's name. I'm in a dangerous mood. I just called up the boss man, told him where to go and just what to do. Crazy, but I did what I had to do. Called me stupid. I just did what I had to do. I had to spend a little time, baby, so I could spend it all on you. I parked the car down the street and I unplugged the phone so it would look just like ain't nobody home. I put a rose on your pillow where you lay your pretty head. Shoulders, bring your dinner to your bed. Look out, baby, I'm in a dangerous mood. I had to steal a little time, baby, so I could spend it all.
Keb Mo from one of my favourite CDs, and the track was called Dangerous Mood, one of my favourites, and not that I get into a dangerous word, well, not too often anyway. But we're talking today to the CEO of Anxiety New Zealand, Sarah Woolard, and psychologist Nadine Isler. And Nadine, I guess after many years of experiencing anxiety and depression, I've come to the conclusion that fear my fear about the future, about maybe being isolated and alone. Those sorts of fears are the things that generate my anxiety. Well, what's the connection between fear and anxiety?
Well, when there's something that we're afraid of, we do tend to spend a lot of cognitive energy on it. So we worry about it. We think about it a lot. And then we might do things, you know, our behaviour will then reflect the way that we're fearful, exactly as you say. And so we might then reach out for things like substances, for example, to numb how we're feeling about the next day or a particular situation or to help us get through. And the other thing too is, like what I was talking about before with the safety behaviours and, you know, escape or avoidance being two of the big ones, we might then start to do less in our lives. And so our worlds become smaller and smaller and more and more things become anxiety-inducing because we're doing them less often.
Yeah, and we become isolated. So we have, we used that word connection, didn't we? We lose our connection.
Absolutely, and we know how important connection with other people is to mental health. It's a simple fact. We know it's very, very important.
So on the positive side, what are some of the things that we can do to help our anxiety, to help those fears?
Well, thankfully, there is quite a range of things that we can do. So there is a positive part of the conversation too, and that's things from lifestyle changes, you know, getting out and talking to more people, being honest about what you're experiencing, things like exercise and fresh air and food and all those things do make a difference because they tend to calm, from a physiological perspective, they calm the body and they help you prepare for what you're the challenges that you're having to deal with. And of course, you know, potentially getting a referral from a GP or going to see somebody about what you're experiencing to be able to talk about it and find out that it's actually you're not alone. Mm-hmm. You know, so many people do experience anxiety and depression, and that there are things that we can do.
The medications, the psychiatric medications for anxiety, tend to be quite addictive. Well, I guess that's my own experience. Nadine is indicating that she doesn't want to enter that part of the conversation, but my experience is that the benzodiazepine, that family of psychiatric medications can be quite addictive. Is this something, Sarah, that you feel you're confident to talk about or not?
Look, you know, it's best to talk to a GP or a psychiatrist about that. And at the Trust, we do have a specialist mental health GP, and we do prescribe on occasion. I know that our doctor does take great care, especially around benzodiazepines. But if somebody's concerned, again, talk to your GP, get as much information as you can, mm-hmm. and make a really informed decision about what you're doing. You know, we take a very holistic approach on things. For some people, medication isn't needed, and for other people, they might be really sensitive to medications, or they may need to try a range of them before they get to one that works at the right dose. And for others, it makes the difference between being able to leave the house or not. Mm-hmm. And that's a really individual situation, and you really need to, you know, see a really good experienced GP around that. Really, there's no other way.
So you mentioned holistic approaches. I guess that's the cognitive behavioural therapy, mindfulness, living in the now, being in the present, breathing. You mentioned to me when you came into the Planet FM studio that I said I was a little anxious because I couldn't access the phone number for today, and you said, well, try a bit of deep breathing. And in fact, somebody else recommended deep breathing to me several months ago, and it works wonderfully.
It's pretty incredible, and it's amazing how something so simple that we do all the time without thinking can really make such a big difference. And what it does is it signals to a part of your brain that's not particularly logical to slow down, and it signals that actually things are okay. So it's like if you kind of got your foot on the accelerator, slowing your breathing down is really putting your foot on the brake, and it's a really neat trick. Now, the good thing with breathing exercises, try and practice and get good at them when you're not highly stressed, because it's really hard to learn new things when we're under pressure. you know, there's some really good breathing apps online with some good information. Or again, you could call our 0800 helpline, 0800 anxiety, and we'll teach you some breathing and some relaxation exercises over the phone.
So you've given us the 0800 helpline. So this is a 24/7 helpline where you've got all these volunteers contributing to supporting people.
Yes, that's correct. So the 0800 helpline is 0800 anxiety. That's 0800-269-4389. If you can't remember that, that's fine. Just pop onto our website. So we get a lot of calls from rural areas where people can be quite isolated. So we help them in the moment and also help them to connect with places of support. We also help family members who are worried about someone they love, or they might need some information about anxiety or something specific like phobias or panic attacks. For example, a mum might call and ask, how many times is too many times for my anxious daughter to wash her hands? And look, that might be a signal that that child needs some help, and early on is generally better.
Right. So your website, can you give us just your website address? Is it anxietynewzealand.co.nz?
It's www.anxiety.org.nz.
Wonderful. Very simple. Well, thank you very much. We've got to wrap it up there. Thank you to Sarah and to Nadine for outlining the work of Anxiety New Zealand and perhaps some of the reasons why we're becoming a more anxious society. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Great.
never miss